I'm Kathy Bosch, and this is a session on what should we tell the kids about sexuality and AIDS. I don't know if you get this cartoon in your papers, Arlo and Janice, or some weeks ago. Arlo, the father, says, Gene's growing up so fast, maybe we should talk to him about, and Mom says, oh, you mean and he says, yeah. And the next one, she says, you're right, especially today with all that. And he says in the last one, something tells me it's not going to be easy. Something tells me it is not going to be easy. Because for most of us, we haven't had a model of somebody telling us the information that we felt we needed to know as we were growing up. So we don't have a model. We often respond in our parenting role the way we were parented. And if this was not part of our parenting, it's going to be sort of lost and forgotten along the way as well as we do our parenting. When I deal with education courses for parents in the area of sexuality, I like to make the distinction between sex and sexuality. I think there's a great deal of hesitation and concern and fear when anything is publicized about a sex education class going into the school or a new sex education program going into the school because we have a bit of confusion about the words. So when I say sex, there are two basic definitions for that little three-letter word. What's the first one? What's one of them?
Gender.
Gender, that's the safe one. Now that we've got the safe one out of the way, what's the other one?
Intercourse.
Intercourse. That usually sometimes has the, like the little, the act or some other euphemism. So the word sex has two basic definitions that include gender, whether we're male or female, and the act of intercourse, how we got to be here somewhere way back. And when we talk about sex education in the school, we generally think of which one? Not gender. And we think it's going to be education about 97 different positions on how to do it, and I don't know that many myself. And so we're always a little bit fearful for what our kids are going to learn. And I propose that we really use the topic instead, the word instead of sexuality, a much more inclusive, broader word that includes all there is about us within our personality that relates to our being a sexual being. Being male and female, or female, how we feel about that, how we relate to other male or females, how we recognize and accept our own feelings, how we make decisions, how we talk about what decisions we make, how we act out our lives, the feelings that we have, the interactions we have with other people, the values that we have. All of those are part of our sexuality, and not just the plumbing, as some call it, the endless pursuit of the fallopian tubes. That's rather sexist because males don't have fallopian tubes. When I have on the board here saying about sexuality that it's a womb-to-tomb process. It's not something that you learn all about by the time you finish sixth grade. And I recall in my meeting with the minors last Monday, I asked some questions about, in a couple of small groups, do they have questions about sexuality? And a couple of girls said, oh, we learned all about that. And I said, tell me when. And, oh, fifth and sixth grades. What grade are you in now? 10th grade. Is there much difference between what you need to know now and what you needed to know as fifth and sixth graders? Well, yeah. Is there much difference in the way you understand things now than you did when you were fifth or sixth graders? Oh, yeah. Could there be that some of the things that were presented maybe as fifth and sixth graders you understood in a different way than what you may need to know about them now? Well, yeah. So I think we continue to learn. I continue to learn all sorts of new things. And I'm much farther beyond grade 10. I had an excellent teacher in the area of broad area of sexuality in my graduate work at Syracuse University by the name of Saul Gordon, who has written a number of materials for parents particularly. One is Let's Make Sex a Household Word is one of his books. Another one that's more current, just recently out, that you'll be very would be very interested in, is a book that's called Raising Your Children Conservatively in a Sexually Permissive World by Saul and Judith Gordon, his wife. And that has some important things to say about us. I took out some books from the library and then left them on a counter as I went on another errand, and they're still in there. But there are a number of books for teenagers and a number of books for parents. There's some in the bookstore of the bookshop on changes and choices growing up as a female teenager and then the counterpart growing up as a male teenager that doesn't talk so much about the issues of sexuality but talks about all those things that lead up to helping to understand how we feel about ourselves, how we feel about the things that are going on around us. Saul Gordon has written a couple on that, two for adolescents, one that's just called You. He's done a number of comic books, 10 Heavy Facts About Sex, How Not to Be an Unwanted Parent, for instance, on drug use, nutrition, alcohol abuse, a variety of things that are very helpful for kids who may not get through a whole book but would read a comic book. I'd like to do several things in our brief time today, and we have about 45 minutes left, to give some basic general ground rules about what should we tell children about sexuality. To answer some of the questions that were put into the box from our parent-teen concern session the other day, and to give some very basic quick information about AIDS, none of which can be done justice to in this amount of time. But let's try to do what we can. In talking about sexuality with for parents and for those teens who are here, to help you and your parents be able to bridge that gap to say it's okay to talk about these issues, maybe even to hear the old fuddy-duddy ideas about it. And I'll venture to say some of my ideas may be rather fuddy-duddy, but some of my ideas may be something that you haven't heard either and that might be rather valuable information for you to hear. First of all, for parents, and for teens also. Parents, whether you believe it or not, accept it or not, do it or not, you are the main sexuality educators of your children. And it may be that even if you do nothing, you're still teaching them something. I think kids learn a great deal about sexuality in the home not by knowing what goes on in the bedroom, but by knowing what goes on in the kitchen, or the living room, or the family room, or in the car. And that's not the back seat, that's even the front seat. How you interact with each other. How males treat females, how females treat males, how you show affection. How you show that you care for each other, how you problem solve with each other. How you share your feelings and communicate with each other. Those are the basics of sexuality. What happens with the glands and the hormones and the fallopian tubes and the testicles and all these other parts of the body are really, in a sense, additional. Important to know. But that whole being of how you interact is the very basis of how we choose and act on our how we choose to act on our sexuality. So you might as well do it, whether you think you'll do it well or badly, because doing it not at all is still doing something, and it's telling your children at whatever age some messages that you may be rather surprised to find out how they interpret them. It's important to use proper terminology. What are some of the possibilities for talking about the various parts of the body? Do you talk about the wiener or do you talk about the penis? Do you talk about what's the counterpart of the penis in the female, whether it's the vulva, the vagina, the clitoris, the labia, Do you know all those parts? I have an interesting story to tell. I'm not sure this is the best one to go on the tape, but I think it's rather interesting. I taught a marriage and family class for Conestoga College students in early childhood education. We had a group of 60, all females in that particular course. One of the sessions I dealt with issues of what would you say in a nursery school, in a preschool experience, that they were doing field work in preschools. If a three-year-old or four-year-old asked you, how are babies born? How are babies made? And there was a lot of discomfort about it, and that's okay. It's okay to be uncomfortable and embarrassed. It doesn't mean that we therefore shut everything off, that we don't talk just because we're embarrassed, but it's okay to admit some discomfort. Gee, I'm not sure exactly how to begin this, but let's see what we can do. A number of them said, I wouldn't say anything at all. Go ask your mother. Or I would just ignore the question. Others said, well, so we began a discussion on this, and I set forth some of my feelings that if a child is old enough to ask a question, I think the child is old enough to be told some information about the question. You may not launch into a 10-minute lecture for a three-year-old, but you can do a 1-minute, 2-minute, and give them some information about that babies are born in a special place in the mother. It's not the stomach or the tummy, but it's a special place called the uterus or the womb. And that it all begins when a sperm from the father joins with an ovum from the mother and a fetus is born. Fetus begins. Notice I didn't say seed and I didn't say egg. Why? For a young child. Children have fantastic imaginations. And what a three-year-old, four-year-old, five-year-old thinks about is that egg that they see on the plate for breakfast. Hard-boiled, soft-boiled, scrambled, poached, whatever. And a seed? Well, there's watermelon and apple and all sorts of other kinds of seeds. So you think if I swallow a couple of those and I eat some eggs, you know, I'm going to have a baby too. So expand their vocabulary. Let them know the proper labels, proper terms for these. So we were discussing how you might respond to these children, and I said you might even talk to them about that males have two openings, one for urine and one for bowel movements. Females have three openings, one for urine, one for bowel movements, and one that is the birth canal. Or if you're talking at all with an older child about intercourse, to say that that is where intercourse occurs. Next class session, a lot of people were very uncomfortable with that. And these were students from the ages of 19 to about 35, 40, some second career people. Very uncomfortable, very unsure some very sure that that was an inappropriate information to give out, that that's just too explosive. How do you decide what are the questions you ask that children ask that you do answer? Say, no, I won't answer this one. Yes, I'll answer this one. If children ask questions, they need to know the information at their level. The next class session, one of the young women came back who was about 21, 22. She said she had a conversation. She said, I asked if they had any further thoughts about what we discussed last time, and a lot of them said they talked with their supervising teachers, and some of them supported me, and some of them supported them. And many of them said they would still feel very uncomfortable telling children in their classes. One student, this 21, 22-year-old female, raised her hand and said, I don't know, I have a different idea than when I left class before, because I went home, I live at home. And I talked to my mother about it. I happen to be number two of five children in our family. And I happened to tell my mom that you also suggested that it may be helpful for you to suggest to females particularly that they might take a mirror to see what are all their genital parts. As who's the children's... on children's television, who talks about boys are fancy on the outside, girls are fancy on the inside, Mr. Rogers, okay. And I use that statement. that they might use a mirror to see the openings, because they can't see them as easily as males can. And so she said, I told my mother that, and my mother told me that you, the instructor, must be the most amoral, insensitive, outrageous woman that exists. And she said, and then I told her about the three openings, and mother said, see, that just proves it. Women only have two. And the girl said, now, remember, I was number two of five children. And I said, Mother, there are three openings. And my mother pounded her fist on the table and said, if that's what she's going to teach you, I'm going to suggest you not take her class any longer. She said, Mother, I finally suggested, Mother, I think you need to take a mirror and go into the bathroom. Mother did, after some hemming and hawing and some gentle prodding from her daughter, and came out very surprised. So we need to use proper terminology. That the vagina is not where a female urinates. That's the urethra, if we want to use a proper term. How do we give them information about proper terminology? We sometimes teach so many pet labels that if you send any of your preschool children off to nursery school, that nursery school teacher is going to learn a whole new vocabulary, because everyone has a different term, and by the time she recognizes what term your child is using, it's probably too late. So, to use proper terminology, let children know what is proper terminology. You may also have your pet terminology, but at least if a doctor asks them about a particular hurt or pain or whatever in a particular area using proper terms, they know what the doctor may be referring to. It's okay when you're in conversations with your children to tell them that you're uncomfortable, because you may not have had the experience of going through this with your own parents, but you want to set the generations in proper sequence again and start it out for them so that they can help with their children. Parents often think, I don't know enough, and that young people are much more knowledgeable. I think the fact that we have a very, very high rate of teen pregnancy indicates that there's some information that's not known, not practiced, or that they feel they're invulnerable, that it happens to others but not to them. Young people who are knowledgeable about sexuality, who feel comfortable in talking with their parents, studies have shown that they experience their first act of intercourse at a much later age than those who feel they know it all, cannot talk to their parents at all, that they are the suppliers of information to all the others. And what happens is that they most often supply myth information, M-Y-T-H, information, rather than correct information. I'm still surprised to find the number of teenagers who say the safest time to have intercourse is in mid-cycle for a female. You can't get pregnant then. That's why we have a lot of teen pregnancies. Or that you can't get pregnant if you practice coitus interruptus removal. The label for people who do that and for those who practice rhythm is generally called parents. Ignorance is a lot more harmful than knowledge in the area of sexuality. My professor, Saul Gordon, used to say, all children play doctor when they're preschoolers, except maybe three or four. Your children might be among those three or four, but all the others do. So the idea that, and that's part of their satisfying curiosity. How do I find out about these things? Well, it might be helpful also. And what do you say when you find that your child is doing this? How many of you parents have ever experienced your children playing doctor with someone? Oh, yeah. It's uncomfortable. You don't know what to say, whether you spank them and send them outside to play, whether you send the other kid home and say, don't you ever play with that person again, or whether you say, it looks like you've got a lot of curiosity. If you have some questions about it, I suggest that we come downstairs and we talk about it. And that this type of play is maybe appropriate for adults, but it's not appropriate for young children. that there are things adults can do that are not in the realm of children's play. Nudity. What about nudity in the home? Some of these are part of the questions that are generally asked by parents. Do we allow nudity to be shown in the home? I didn't grow up with a house that expressed nudity very much, but our children have grown up in a house in which that has been a fairly common thing. And so I've doing more work in sexuality education, I asked them when they were in their teens, you know, maybe we've forgotten some things and we should start closing the door or not sharing the bathroom at the same time. And they looked and they said, why? And we said, well, the issue of nudity, are you embarrassed? And they looked at each other and looked at us and said, if you were to start closing all the doors now and putting all the bathrobes on and such that you aren't always doing, we would think something might be wrong. So it depends upon what you're comfortable with. If you're comfortable with it and the children are comfortable with it, I don't think it's giving ideas. When the children decide to close their doors, that's the time to respect privacy and to respect the concerns about nudity. But it may be something that you talk about in your own home and deal with at your own comfort level. What is comfortable for you? I'm not a Freudian psychologist. I don't believe in some of the things that Freud says about that. If a child hasn't asked questions about sexuality by the time of age 5, tell them. You don't wait until a child can describe that cow standing out in a field or the dog running across the street to say that's a bow-wow or that's a doggy. You label dogs, you label cows before they can even describe them. So sometimes you may need to give the information about their own body, about babies, about pregnancy before they are asking the question, before they laugh at some relative who's coming in who's 9 months pregnant, 9 months minus 2 days pregnant, and they say, why is she so fat? And you're embarrassed and you spank them and send them off to bed. And I think it is helpful to say, now, Aunt Jane is going to look a little bit different than the last time you saw her because she's expecting a baby. And follow it up, what does that mean? Or why was she looking different? Well, a baby grows. And there has to be space for that, so what looks like it's her tummy is going to be much larger, but it's not her tummy. And then go into what I said a little earlier. Important information to share with children is that males and females are both important. One sex, one gender does not have it all over the other. And I think that's very difficult when you think of all the studies that have been done with expectant parents saying, do you want a boy or a girl? And how many say they want a boy? What's the cultural significance to that? The girls get second rate. Or if you get them, then you got to take them. But other than that, if you have a choice. And, you know, having two daughters, I'm pleased I have two daughters. I don't believe, you know, I feel that I had a great strain taken off of me and that one of my husband's brother had 5 sons. So I didn't need to feel that our family needed to carry on the Bosch name. So I could be happy with what we got. So we want to avoid the double standard, both in how we show affection to males and female children, what we allow them to do, what information we tell them, and what we allow them to do. That if we aren't going to allow the 14 or 15-year-old girl to stay out after 11 o'clock at night, maybe we ought not allow the boy to stay out after 11 o'clock at night. And we talked to the female about sexuality and intercourse, that we also say some of the same things and same responsibilities to males rather than boys will be boys. But who are they going to be boys with? Your daughter. Parents worry a lot about masturbation. I think it was C. Dudley White, one of the physicians to an early president, who said there's nothing really wrong with masturbation except you don't meet very many friends that way. Lots of people masturbate and lots of people don't. There may be some particular religious significance for some religions, some prescriptions against it, but I don't think I've seen anything written in our Lutheran statement on marriage, sex, and the family that say anything against it, that we're going to grow hair on our hands and warts all over our face if we do it. There's no harm if you do it, there's no harm if you don't do it. The important thing to get across is that it's done privately. And you can do that with your two-year-old or three-year-old. Three-year-old who is beginning to learn where to go to the bathroom, not in the middle of the living room floor or out on the front lawn, but you use the toilet inside the house, can also be taught that that's something that provides some good feelings. And if you feel that you want to do that, then it's something you do up in your bedroom or in the bathroom that's in private, not in front of other people. I also believe if we do not put a lot of guilt trips on some of our teens, kids as they grow up, perhaps the use of masturbation would resolve some of their feelings of needs to have intercourse. May not be as much fun as doing it with someone else, but it's better than getting a sexually transmitted disease or becoming a parent or a variety of feeling that you're used. What do you need to tell pubescent males and females as they grow up? I think each needs to know what is happening to the other gender at this time. That you don't just take girls in a fifth grade classroom and show them a film about menstruation and don't say anything else and tell them, don't tell anyone else what's happening. It's a secret. Well, I think there's a lot of unfair, improper teasing that's done between males and females when they think, aha, I know something, and I can get your goat, or I can make you embarrassed, or I can make you feel something bad about it, so we can use it as jokes. If they're both told the information about each other, they have that information, and they can't use it as weapons on each other. So you talk to females about menstruation, that this is a natural process of the body that may happen any time between 9 and 15. And it's going down in age, partly because of our nutrition. No one knows really what sets the biological clock that starts menstruation for females, except it's an individual clock that's set in each one's body that relates to the production of hormones, the secretions from the pituitary. That set that clock in motion for each particular person. There's some ideas that it may have to do with the percentage or ratio of fat content in the body, and those who are slimmer, dancers, for instance, athletic physique females may menstruate later, but that's not always true. Generally it will be, but not always. That at the same time, the initiation into puberty for males is nocturnal emissions or wet dreams that may have nothing to do with erogenous thoughts or dreams. That it may be your own body's, the nature's way of relieving the supply of sperm that had built up. And that by the time you come into your late teens, it's not as it's under more control than it is at the younger teenage years. And that can start as early as 11, 12, most often 13, more closely in the 13, 14 years. And that's at the time when a male can become, can impregnate a female. Questions often ask, can a female become pregnant before she has ever menstruated? And the answer is yes. Because she may be about ready to menstruate in a fertile period before that first menstruation, and the fertile period occurs before menstruation happens, and the menstruation is the sloughing off of that building up of the lining in the uterus that prepares for a fertilized egg. If there is not a fertilized ovum, then the lining, the unfertilized ovum descends and is disposed, descends through the channels, and the lining follows shortly after, not always within several days. But if it's fertilized at the time it's in the fallopian tube, then it can a fetus can be formed. And the fertilization takes place in the fallopian tubes, not in the uterus. The uterus is where it attaches to the lining for further growth. And generally, females are told about menstruation, and generally, males are not told about nocturnal emissions or wet dreams. They'll find out about it soon enough, and then they can be embarrassed about the wet sheets and think that they've peed in the bed, and be embarrassed and uncomfortable and not sure what's happening to them. It's a marvelous set of videotapes out that are available for various schools, and sometimes in video shops. One is called Am I Normal, which is about growth and development for males. The other for female, the female counterpart is Dear Diary, and they're put out by the Boston Women's Collective. Am I Normal is a much better film than Dear Diary. They didn't get out of some of the stereotypes of females in Dear Diary. Why must parents be educators of their children? Because they have no choice. Silence influences children in a negative way, and I think children, whatever age to adolescence, get so many messages out wherever they are, in the street, hearing music. The only way that you could prevent them from hearing outside voices is if they're deaf, blind, and you lock them in a closet. I don't think it's possible to keep them uninformed about what's going on in the world with regard to sexuality. Look at every advertisement. Look at all your television programs. Might have been possible in our days because sexuality was a very hidden thing and it didn't come out in any television programs. You didn't have an early form of Dallas or Falcon Crest or any of those others that you do have now. So you need to be involved. And in the programs I do for parents, I have a 6-7 minute slideshow that I use that I called Current Sex Educators. It is photos of advertisements, photos of t-shirt transfers, photos of record covers, record posters, some bumper stickers. Usually the best ones are the ones that are going the wrong direction down the road when you can't don't have a camera in hand. But I started that collection when I first saw my mother, my mother-in-law, who was in her 80s at the time, told about seeing this girl enter, come on a bus that she was on. And the girl had a t-shirt with an egg on it. And the egg had a smiley face. And underneath the smiley face was written, "You'd smile too if you'd just been laid." There's a lot of double messages kids get. Or the button that my daughter saw at the youth convention at Purdue, the Lutheran youth convention at Purdue a few years ago, that said, "Clergy do more." How do we show affection to our children? Do we stop with that at age 5? How we continue to show affection feeds their hungry skin. Did you know that you had hungry skin that didn't need protein emollients or oil of Olay, but needs good hugs, good arms around you, holding your hand, the positive touch that gives you, that you feel good and comfortable and accepted from. And that can do a lot more to building a good relationship between parent and teen than all the rules and regulations that you might set up. Information about sexuality is not the kind of thing that you give in a 1 10-minute walk in a park or out to get ice cream that you've never done with your child before, but somebody says, as this cartoon did, "It's about time, I should tell you about, so I will, now I've done it, goodbye." It's something that begins at that very early age and continues all the way on. There's still times when our 22-year-old and our 25-year-old are home and out, we'll be driving somewhere, I'll talk about some things, particularly AIDS. And they'll say, "Oh, we've talked about that before." And I'll say, "Well, I'm not sure who I've talked to about what. So let's check out what were some of the things that we talked about and find out from them what are the things that they're hearing. What might be important information for me to hear?" When your child asks a question, it may be very important to ask, first of all, "What do you think about it? Tell me what you've heard. What are kids saying?" Does a couple of things. One, lets them know that what they think is important. Two, it lets you know whether they have some myth information. Three, it buys you a couple of minutes to think, how am I going to answer? And that would be the most important of all. So it's okay. And it's okay to say, "I don't know, but let's find out." I'm not sure we're expected to be encyclopedias all the time. Well, those are some basics. When do you tell children about birth control? You may have to say something about it in the very beginning stage when they talk about how a baby's made. Can I see the next time you decide to have one? And to be able to say that that's a very private experience between mom and dad. And it is not something that's on display for other people to see. And to say there are times that people, it's a good... it's a good feeling. One of the great difficulties is that we want to say to our children, don't. And as Saul Gordon was on NBC or CBS some years ago, national television, from a program he was doing in Rochester, New York, he comes on with a marvelous Jewish accent, and he says in the beginning, parents say no, clergy say no, the schools say no, I say no, but who's listening? And we may need to think about that when we make some decisions about what do we tell kids? Because we may be saying no, the church may be saying no, but are they listening? And as a friend of mine who is the consultant for family life education in the separate school system, which is the parochial system in Canada, said that she, right before she retired, one of her last major efforts and successes was to get through a birth control course for eighth graders in the public, in the separate school system. Now, our public schools don't have that yet in most places, even in grade 11. I said, how did you do that? And she said, one of the reasons for the separate school system is to teach our children to be good decision makers. And I said, what are you including in it? And she said, everything. How can we teach kids to be good decision makers if we don't give them information from which to make their decisions? We can tell them what the church feels about some things, how I feel about some things, but they're going to make the decisions in the final end. And we need to let them know what are all the possibilities. We can tell them our values, but they're going to be forming their values. We can tell them, give them some information, look at alternatives, look at consequences, give them all the information that they need to know so they can be good decision makers and good livers of the faith, people who act out our faith. Well, a lot of the questions that we had about sexuality from the parents deal with the issues, what do we tell our teens about sex? What do they really want to know? Can we tell them? Do we have information to tell them? I think having sexual intercourse before the age of 18 is like walking around with a lighted time bomb in your back pocket. I believe that. Kids may not listen, but I think there's so many changes that are going on in an adolescent's body, so much that they have to know about themselves, their feelings, their decisions, what they're doing, how they're learning, how they interrelate with people. And just building up their own self-esteem as being a worthy, important person, that to add the explosiveness of such intense feelings as a sexual encounter with another human being is akin to walking around with a grenade with the pin pulled out in your back pocket. You don't know what's going to happen with it. Will it go off? I think the fact that either number one or two basic causes of death among teenagers is either suicide or accidents has a lot to say about that. How kids feel about themselves, if they're either worthwhile or not worthwhile, depends a lot to how they feel about themselves from and the messages they get from other people. If they put all their eggs in the basket of a handsome sports football player or that cheerleader, and began to plan their life around that person, and the other person decides to go off with another cheerleader or another football player, and they're left behind, it can be pretty devastating. That person knows all about me, knows my ins and outs, figuratively and literally, and now can be laughing about me. That can be devastating. The do it and tell feelings that a lot of people have about what happens, that what has been private is now public. Everybody's going to know about who I am, what I'm like. Am I going to be regarded as a person that's important or a thing? Pin cushion or whatever, punch board. What about the fear of AIDS, herpes, chlamydia? See, yes, in this day and age right now, we're hearing so much about AIDS. It's important that we hear it and that we read and we find out what's happening. But what's also happening at the same time is that herpes and chlamydia, which is a new, it's not a flower, yeast infection that's come up, that can cause sterility among females, that can cause, can be the basis for pelvic inflammatory disease, that can cause a lot of difficulty, discomfort, pain, is not being talked about. Unless you happen to go into a family planning clinic and see one of their posters, or be on a campus where they're handing out information on all of these different kinds of sexually transmitted diseases. Intercourse is no longer just fun and games. Intercourse is a very serious action, decision, behavior to engage in. Because it could mean a noose around your neck. In other words, death with AIDS as it's come up. How many of you have read much at all? How many of you have read about AIDS? Have been in any discussion about AIDS? What causes AIDS? Where it's come from? The realization that that in Africa, where it really first began, it's a heterosexual disease. It's not a homosexual disease. It perhaps is more prevalent among homosexual population in this country because that's where it may have gotten carried to. But it is no longer just a homosexual disease. That it is being found in increasing numbers in females who are not homosexual in heterosexual males. That it is no longer something that happens to someone else. How many of you know of a person or know of somebody who knows of someone who has AIDS? Okay. How many of you know that AIDS is basically spread through body fluids of either blood or semen or vaginal fluids, through contact with dirty needles, whether it's generally through drugs? But I don't know about your areas of the country. Tattoos are becoming very popular up in Canada. And I worry about that too, whether those are disposable needles that are being used. And I brought that up to one group and three people had, and then I realized they had tattoos as your face fell. Or the possibility of an infected female giving birth to an infant that will have AIDS, or AIDS-related complex that may develop into AIDS. The fact that although you may not have AIDS, you may have AIDS-related complex, that you have the virus within your system that is not showing up, but that you can, you're contagious, that anyone that you have intercourse with, you can share that disease with. Or that you've heard that when you decide to go to bed with someone other than your partner, if you're not in a partner relationship, if you decide to have intercourse with someone, that you are having intercourse with everyone that person has had intercourse with over the last 5-6 years or more. First they were saying 2-3 years, then 5-6 years, and it could be up to 10 years. The virus often shows itself in 6 weeks, but it may take 6 months. It may take 5 years before the virus may show itself into a full-blown case of AIDS. So you may not know. It may not show up on a test, a blood test, until 6 weeks to 6 months have passed. So that may mean if you're virgins and you want to make sure that whether your partner, your newly chosen partner, that you've decided that this is a relationship that's important to you, and whether it's within or without the confines of marriage, do you wait 6 months? Take a test. Wait 6 months. Remain celibate for those 6 months. Take a test again before you feel that you are really going to be safe, because it can cost you your life. You understand that it affects the development of your immune system, and that is part of its acquired immune deficiency syndrome, part of its name. It was not named until 1981. They did not signal out the virus until late 83. They still don't know what to do about it. There's no known cure. And they suspect that they would probably, it'll be a long 10 years or more off before they would ever find a cure. For those who have AIDS, they may be able to delay some of the symptoms in those who have AIDS to expand their life, but they cannot cure it. That they do not see in the foreseeable future a cure for someone with AIDS. So what does this say about all our sexuality? What do we say to kids? And how kids, I hear that that preschoolers on the playground are playing tag, touching another one, saying, you've got AIDS, you've got AIDS. That school-age kids are taunting other kids with, you've got AIDS, don't want to be near you, don't want to be near you. How afraid are we of AIDS? Do you remember when cancer first became a real serious disease? And you were afraid to be near a person that had cancer? Remember when you had polio? I mean, I had polio when I was little. And it was not one of the first years that it was out. But people were really scared. I lived on a farm. They really wondered whether they should accept my father, the milk supply from our cows, or the eggs from our chickens. Because it might be spread through that. Well, I think we've got some of those same irrational fears, and maybe you say they're not irrational. I think the things you need to be careful about in the contagion of AIDS is dealing with drugs and shared needles, dealing with intercourse with people that you don't know what their backgrounds, where they have been, and whether they, if you have been in a monogamous relationship for 5 to 10 years and you can fully trust your partner, then you're home free. If you don't know, you've got some real difficult things to deal with. Am I safe? Are we safe? To recognize that it is not spread through mosquitoes, it's not spread through coffee cups, it's not spread at this point that we know anything about through common cup at communion, for even sharing bath towels, or the toilet seats, or glasses. They have no reported cases thus far of families who are taking care of AIDS victims who have gotten AIDS from the victim they've cared for. No cases. The only cases that have happened thus far in hospitals have been where there has been a cut or direct contact with an open sore and blood from an infected person. Now, there are lots and lots of stories going around that I know so-and-so who did such-and-such, but I really need to know, and I think it really needs to be a pretty tested case before it becomes this is how it's passed. Let me stop with that, and let's ask for some questions. I understand teenagers wanted to be able to come to this session not only to listen but to talk. What are some questions? I haven't covered everything. Cover some basics. What are your questions about it?
I guess one thing that I'd like to point out is it's not a question, it's just a matter of awareness that the homosexual population, the gay and lesbian population, is very real. And for those of you who are parents here, statistics, if they carry over for whatever population you are in, the Lutheran Church, whatever statistics say that 1 in 10 people is gay or lesbian. And so if you just assume throughout the unraveling of your child's sexuality throughout the years, and it isn't unraveling, that they are straight, 1 chance in 10 is your mom. And I think that's a startling statistic to be faced with, but it's just something to be aware of.
And I think it's also important if we're going to deal with the issue of homosexuality that kids do not catch homosexuality from a teacher or a neighbor that's going to talk them into being a homosexual. The information is still out on what's the basic cause, whether it's a genetic cause, probably more likely genetic than it is environmental, you know, mother this or dad did that. They found no basic underlying, this is what's basically the cause in the majority of cases of homosexuals. They're human beings. They're creatures of God. And they're not going to make you into a homosexual just because you talk to them, or make your child into a homosexual if it happens to be your child's Sunday school teacher. Rapes and sexual abuse are more often done by heterosexuals, 90% of the time or more. I'd be afraid of heterosexuals, not homosexuals.
Do you have any feelings or advice relative to the maternal and paternal responsibilities for communication with children of the same or different gender?
And can't... Should dad talk to sons and mom talk to daughters?
Yes, and vice versa or whatever. Or should it all be done in a family context?
I think ideally it should be done in both, all three. The father talk with both son and daughter, mother talk with both son and daughter, mother and daughter talk, mother and father talk with both sons and daughters together. Saul Gordon says, I don't care whether it's, and particularly in single parent families, if it's it's a single mother or the single father that's dealing with the opposite gender child to talk about issues of sexuality. The only thing that's probably going to be most convenient is that if it's a dad who has to cover these topics, that the dad might find a female to talk about feminine products, because it'll be just a little bit easier if you have to do any demonstrations. How do you use a Tampax or use a Kotex? Yes.
I'd like to say, as an educator, I really support the basically your entire lecture here, but the one premise there, the one statement earlier that you said, that sexual education should be done at home, begins at home, because it is not focused on in the church, in the school, you know, any place else, but that parents do continue the sexual education with their children. I really support that.
Yeah.
I also would like to say that it's very difficult as a parent to do that, to feel at ease to do that. And that I don't think that you can make mistakes as a parent. I think that if you try it, it gets a little bit easier. But I think the communication is so important.
And it's okay to say, I don't feel very comfortable about this, but let's do it anyway. And I hope I haven't given the misunderstanding. I think it needs to be done in all those places. And I think the church primarily needs to be doing something, and it's not. I worked as an educator for a family planning agency in Massachusetts, and we couldn't get a program into our adult forum. I did it in the neighboring congregational church, and we had people from our church come there. And I like the model that has both parents and kids together, and I wrote a curriculum for that, which is available out of the Family Planning Council of Western Massachusetts in Northampton. So that you have time to talk together, and then you break up into age groups, and teens talk together with another leader, preteens talk together with another leader, and the parents talk together with another leader. And then you come back and you go separate, and you come back so that you each hear some of the basics, that you each know what the other knows, but then you can deal with it at your own particular level. And that the home has to be the place where values comes in. You can't teach your children values in a direct sense that they'll take it like 2 + 2 = 4. This is my value, so therefore it's going to transform into yours. But that you live out your values and so clearly, and you talk about them as being important to you, that they become catching. And you can discuss them. I'm sure that there are values that my daughters have that are not particularly mine, but they're theirs, and I respect them. And that I certainly have changed a number of my values from my parents, and I think they respected me. And I hope we can continue to respect, but keep that conversation going. And it may, even if you disagree with that value, to continue the acceptance, to share some information without the ordering, directing, warning, threatening, controlling part. Say, I really feel strongly about. And to share those feelings. Frank.
Well, Kathy, if I may, I'd like to, I'm happy to hear the comment about homosexuality. I'm a gay man. A very lonely time. I realized I was different when I was in grade school. And I had no one
in my grade school years, my teen years, and up to around the time I was 20 that I could even talk to get any information. I was scared to death, scared to talk to my pastor, to my parents, to friends, and the only information I had to go on as I was growing up was the jokes that I heard when I was in school, and thinking that I wasn't like those kinds of jokes that I was hearing, so I couldn't be gay. It must be a phase I was going through. Well, it wasn't a phase I was going through. And for a lot of young people now, there still isn't. Basically, 20 years later, there still isn't any good place that a lot of gay people can go to find out answers to their questions and find out what it is that they're feeling, what it is that's happening to them, and that the fact that they're different doesn't necessarily make them worthless. I really think something that's overlooked and perhaps underestimated in a lot of cases, particularly in connection with teen suicides, is the fact that a lot of these people may be struggling with questions of sexuality and maybe, you know, what if I'm lesbian or gay? You know, I don't think I can face that, and they don't have anybody to go to, they don't have anybody to ask questions of. And I really think that's sad. The church is not dealing with the issue very effectively. There's a hit and miss policy. There's some pastors who are willing to bring that up in adult forums. Unfortunately, frequently that information doesn't get to the young people who are the ones who may be struggling most intimately with that question. So I think it really is something that needs to be emphasized. Sexuality in general, yes. Homosexuality in particular, I think, needs to be talked about, though.
Thank you, Frank, for that. I think that's very important to look at the issues and look at, to feel comfortable, and I'm sure Frank would welcome to have some further conversations with you. How do you deal with those particular issues? How do you deal within your church? How do you deal within your own family to talk about it? And to perhaps, not just perhaps, to wipe out those unkind, unfair comments, the kinds of stories that we laugh at that really put down other people, whether they're homosexuals, whether they happen to be AIDS victims, whether they happen to be black, whether they happen to be Hispanic or whatever. You know, we tell a lot of Swedes and Norwegian stories and Polish stories and such, depending upon what part of the country you come in. And I like the person who said, I think we need to switch all of those out, and if we have to put an ethnic origin, use the Hittites. I mean, there's no one around any longer to feel embarrassed. And I think that ought to be true to all the various classifications of people, whether it's men or women, that are used as the brunt of a lot of stories. That we are all God's creatures, and we don't have the right to really laugh and put down someone else that God accepts.
So don't talk about it at all.
I'm glad you brought that up. How do teens deal with parents? I think there's some door openers that teens can use, and there's some door openers that parents can use. And the teens can say, Mom or Dad, I have a friend who, make up a story. Share a story for whatever purpose you want to get through to. Talk about that friend, whether it's yourself or someone else, to begin opening the door. Mom or Dad, we haven't talked about this before, and I think it's about time. I remember hearing someone at Holden Village who said, open the door. Buy the tape. Pick up a book from the library and say, Mom and Dad, I've read through this, and I think you might be interested in reading through it, and then we can have a conversation about it. I think teens, I'm so glad you're here, and I'm glad you asked the question, because I think you can be the salvation of your parents in this issue. And you can say, hey, let's talk about it. Or, I've heard some things about this such and so in school. Did you know about that? Or, what do you think about that? or deliberately turn the information around and see if they'll catch it, whether it's right or wrong. See if they know.
I've been listening to your lecture.
Yes, you have. And the next time you see, you go into bookstores, you go into magazine shops, next time you see a magazine that has a title, "What Should You Tell Your Teens About Sexuality?", buy it and give it to your mom and dad and say, "You might find this rather interesting. I just read it." And if they say, "Well, if you read it, I don't have to talk about it," you can say, "Oh, but I think you ought to know it, and I'm going to, I'll ask you some questions to see if you've caught some things that I caught in it, and you can check them out just like they check you out in some things." Turnaround's fair play in that.
As a parent of a teenager, I would tell teens, since my teenager's not here right now, I would tell teens that I don't know if I speak for most parents, but from this parent, I would just love to have a door opener come from my teenager that would give me an entree. But it's that breaking the barrier, that first barrier. It's getting that door open. And I think once it opens and some dialogue starts, it will get easier and easier. And I've had an easier time with my son, who's now 19, than with my daughter, who's 13. I've kind of left that up to my wife. But I think there's some time, and my wife left my son and me. But I think it should be more of a family kind of thing. There should be interaction from both parents to children or adolescents of both genders.
I think that isn't.
We should make it that way with my son. I'd like to make it that way with my daughter.
I think that is important to have it go both ways, for parents to talk openly about it, and for parents to use some of the same door openers on their kids. I heard this lady at Holden Village talk about, and I guess we haven't done it before, let's start talking about it now. But it's so helpful. There's a little baby here, you know, begin talking about the labels. The child can't understand what you're saying, but it makes you get more comfortable. And you begin to, the child only hears that soft, child hears that soft voice and knows that you're talking to it, and that's important for the child, but it certainly helps you to feel more comfortable with it.